Is it too soon?
Oh, it's never too soon. Hello and welcome to the Hackaday Podcast. I'm Elliot Williams.
And I'm Christina Panos.
This is episode 338, Smoothing 3D Prints, Reading CNC Joints, and Detecting Spicy Shrimp. This week in Hackaday News, we just started our newest contest, the Hackaday Component Abuse Challenge.
Hooray!
Yeah, the basic idea is to take whatever parts and use them the wrong way. This is like the most Hackaday contest ever. Using resistors as heaters, using LEDs as light sensors, using parts out of their comfort zones, but nonetheless having them continue to function. If it releases the magic smoke and fails to work anymore, that's not a very good entry. If it's just that close to releasing the magic smoke, but still continues to function, I think that's a good one. Al suggested using inductors as magnetic sensors or as electromagnets. I mean, there's just all sorts of things. All of the off-label uses of electronic components are fair game for this one.
How have you misused a component lately?
Lately? I don't know. I've been pretty good lately.
Okay.
I've been fairly good. I did try the LEDs as light sensors thing way back when that was making the rounds. That one comes from, well, it was, I guess, initially popularized by Forrest Mims, who was actually doing, he was doing kind of spectroscopy on the open sky by using LEDs of different colors, which are then receptive to different wavelengths. And for the price of three LEDs, you can measure the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere above you. I think that's really rad.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying to have them blink and have another one read it. And my personal experience was that from batch to batch and brand to brand, and must be chemistry differences inside or who knows what, there's tremendous difference in how they perform as receivers, even if they perform basically the same as LEDs. So yeah, watch out. When you're using things for their wrong purposes, they don't necessarily meet specs, right? It sounds obvious when I say it, but you know. So I had one sweet bag of LEDs that actually worked super well to receive, and in particular from themselves. And I'm actually still got the bag in my closet. I probably still have a couple hundred of them. You know, you only need 5 or 10, and then you have the rest of a batch of 200.
Yeah.
So anyone want any red LEDs? Nice, crystal clear. But anyway, so far the comments section on that one has been full of people saying, hey, what if I did this? So we just started up this week. We'll see what people come up with. And as they start filling up the projects over on Hackaday.io, it'll be more and more interesting. You got 8 weeks, ends November 11th. We're just in the beginning phases. Stay tuned to Hackaday if you want to see them before we get to judging. And if you're going to contribute one, please, please, please do. Just head on over to Hackaday.io to the Component Abuse Challenge Contest. We'll throw the links in the show notes. You can't miss it if you go to the intro article on Hackaday either.
Don't be shy. Step right up.
Exactly. In sad surplus news, American Science and Surplus ends online sales. This is, if you've received their catalog, you know it from its whimsical drawings that accompany the electronic parts they sell. Great descriptions. Honestly, it was a fun catalog to read just because of the crazy ideas that they come up with to try to sell you this surplus junk they've got. And of course, if you're a person like me, that totally speaks to you. So it looks like of the three physical stores, two of them are staying open. The one that isn't is the one that's kind of on the way to O'Hare Airport from Chicago, which is actually the one I've been to. They haven't found a buyer yet, but man, that thing is just a crazy giant surplus store. It's just fun to walk around. My sister used to live in Chicago, and I did a detour on the way out and must have spent an hour in there just walking around, and did not exit empty-handed, but I was still able to board the plane. So,
oh, that's good. That's
no, fine. No problems. Have you ever been to one of these?
No, I used to get the catalog, though.
Did you?
Yeah. So that's, it's sad. It's very sad.
Yeah. Some part of me wants to have a surplus store in the neighborhood and not want to do it online. I appreciate the online bit, but half of the glory is just going down there and picking the brains of the electronics nerds behind the counter and, you know, just wandering up and down the aisles like, you know, kid in candy store. I grew up in Nashville. We had one called Javanco, and the guy who ran that, unsurprisingly, was a big electronics nerd, and he was awesome and extremely helpful, and it closed when he retired because just nobody else. I mean, I think the business is a hard business. You're basically buying stuff surplus as cheap as you can and then trying to sell it to a very weird niche crowd of super nerds who want to try to build stuff out of junk. Like it's like being Akaday or something. You're aiming at a small market.
How do we reach these people?
It's not like you're selling cell phones. So it takes a certain dedication to the trade to keep a store like that going. And I know that when, I don't know his first name, Javan, decided to retire, that was the end of Javanco. So
darn you, next generation.
Yeah, you young whippersnappers.
Slackers, yeah.
Get on my lawn and sell electronics. Anyway, if you haven't had the chance to visit your local surplus store, you should absolutely look it up and do it soon while it's still there. And spill one for American Science and Surplus.
This is a journey into sound.
What's that sound?
What's that sound?
How about a little what's that sound?
Okay.
This week is a sound reveal week. That means we played the sound last week. Everybody submitted their guesses, and we'll see if Christina can get it before I let you all know what it is, and we pick a random lucky winner.
Here we go. Carmen San Diego?
Yeah, you're the right time zone. Era.
That's all I got.
Science show of that times.
Bill Nye?
Ah, Next Door Neighbor. It's the intro music to Beakman's World?
Beakman's World, okay. I don't think I watched that.
Described accurately by Pagoda 84 in his response, Beakman's World, or rather, Bill Nye on crack. That basically sums it up. It was a like manic science show. It was absolutely hilarious.
Like Pee Wee Herman?
Yes.
Playhouse? Okay.
Yes. And in fact, the theme music, last theme music one we did was 2001 Space Odyssey, and it was written by, you know, Gheorghe Ligeti, abstract intellectual composer of the time. And this one is written by Mark Mothersbaugh, the lead of Devo, who then went on to do a film and TV show music writing career, and indeed did the theme music for Pee Wee Herman as well.
Nice.
Devo is in both Beakman's World and Pee Wee Herman. But so there's some insight into the show for you. My favorite part was the character Lester, who in the early version, or maybe just the pilot, was a lab rat puppet. And then at some point they decided to have a human in a not very good rat costume play Lester. And he's just the best character because he's pissed at being in a rat costume and being in a very bad rat costume. And yet he's playing like he's Beakman's lab rat. It's lovely. Lovely.
But was Lawrence Fishburne on that show?
No.
Okay.
I mean, he might have been.
Because he was on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Was he really?
Yeah.
No way.
He's Cowboy Curtis.
That's funny. Anyway, 31 answers, 23 of them correct. I think because Beakman's World is so whacked out. These are the responses with the most crazy nicknames. I'm going to run them down for you real quick because they're so funny. Leads off with Moss Fetish 69. Bob spelled backwards. Jim T. Rat, Lester's understudy. Ratcheting Crimpers is a great nickname. Unlawful Falafel is hard to say. Stand Back Burrito, I don't know what that means, but I love it. Beak Mania, hanging with Lester at the furry convention, and Giantest of Scientists. Anywho, congrats to everybody who got it right. How am I going to roll a 23-sided die? That's tricky.
Mm.
I'm going to take the hash of the What's That Sound sound file and modulo that by the number of people we've got. Here goes. Random hash, 23. And the lucky number is 16, which is Montana Mike. Congratulations. Beekman's World intro jingle. Absolutely right. That's funny. This one had a lot of wrong guesses in the beginning. And then from like halfway through, literally everybody got it right. It's the second half of the answers are all 100% correct. Anyway, Montana Mike, I'll be getting in touch with you and get you a Hagaday Podcast t-shirt. Everyone else, listen in next week for your chance to give it a guess. All right, enough goofing around. Time to get to work here. Let's talk hacks.
Okay.
My first hack this week, smooth, non-planar 3D ironing, is an interesting take on non-planar 3D printing, in big air quotes, by Tentech. So ironing 3D prints is where you run the 3D printer head just over the surface at the top when you're done. And the idea is to kind of smooth it down, right? And so you either extrude a tiny little bit or none at all, and you just run the hot nozzle over it to smooth it out. This only works with basically flat surfaces because the nozzles have sharp edges and they catch on things, and there's other stuff hanging off your hot end that'll catch on things if it's not a flat surface when you're doing that. So it's kind of an unreliable niche case, this top surface ironing. Tentech's idea is to change that by using essentially a ball on a probe. So it's like a much longer, it looks almost like a drill bit with a round ball on the end. It's heated, and so he can go up and down and smooth the print with that. Because it's rounded, he can smooth it, you know, all the way up to the edges. So if you imagine a print that kind of curves up from flat to 90 degrees vertical, it can actually do all of those. It can't get under overhangs to smooth things out, but basically anything else it can do. And so this is his first step toward experimenting with this. He makes a little smoother head out of an aluminum rivet that has a round head on it. He finds he has to insulate it and stuff to keep it hot because it's sticking way out of the hot end of his 3D printer. This does mean switching out from your normal extruder nozzle to this particular heated round ball on a stick that he has here. It also means you have to run special software to contour the top surface, and he's written that software, and you should go check that out. It's a Python script, and actually, if you just go look at that on his GitHub, it gives you an idea of kind of all of the horrible calibration you have to do to make this thing work. Like, you know, you have to figure out how tall the ball is, how the diameter is, of course, but then also how fast you want to move across and how hard you want to press down, you know, what the spacing between passes should be, and. You should really have a look. This is brand new stuff. Like, I've never seen anyone do this before. And so all of the possible variables you can vary are out there on the table for you to play with. And I think that's really, really cool. This is just like, it's a new thing I've never seen before. It's total greenfield. And what it does is maybe trivial. It just flattens the top surface of your print so it looks smooth. But that's something that really bothers a lot of people when they're trying to make a prop or whatever. And my son's been 3D printing a lot of stuff that he wants to look like metal. And he has been sanding and sanding and sanding and then primer and then sand it and then primer and then sand it and then finally paint it. Like, it's a heck of a lot of work. And so I appreciate this attempt at making it easier to make the surfaces of your 3D prints smooth and not look like they're so 3D printed. All at the same time, you know, retaining the benefits of regular old planar slicing up until the last phase. So I think that's the cool bit here. So far, we haven't seen anyone else other than Tentech working on this, but I imagine we will. I imagine we'll see a bunch of people riffing on this idea in the near future. Looks like fun if you had like one of those 3D printers that has two heads on one rail or a tool head changer or something. You could do this pretty easily and automatically, and that would make things a lot easier. It's so analogous to the way you cut things on a CNC mill, you know, a CNC router, where, you know, often you take some first passes with a really big bit to just get the bulk chopped away, and then you move to a finer bit and a finer bit to get into the tighter resolution zone, and then maybe finish pass with a ball end mill to get these kind of nice flowy contours. This is exactly that, but kind of the 3D printer post-processing version of it. And it does make me think that maybe you want heads with different radiuses, or maybe a flat head and a ball head. Like, there are a whole bunch of weird possibilities opening up once you start thinking about making custom funny post-ironing tools. Do you see that print in there?
Yes, that's pretty.
It looks pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, it's still got lines where it's dragged across, where it's dragged the smoothing head across, but it,
yeah,
it pretty much obliterated the layer lines.
Yeah.
Hmm.
My first hack comes from Ancient, a closer look inside a robot's typewriter-inspired mouth. The astute among you will remember that I covered this thing the last time I was on the podcast. And serendipitously enough, there's an update to the project the very week that I'm due back in the chair. So we're going to talk about it again. Fresh nightmares.
Exactly.
So if you'll recall, this is a talking robot with a moving mouth. The mouth moves very quickly to keep up with the speech, and it's pretty convincing. And the way the mouth moves was previously revealed to be quite a bit like the IBM Selectric golf ball type element from the 1960s. However, the difference is in the mechanisms that drive the two. Whereas the Selectric's element was driven by a linkage called a wiffle tree, this robot's mouth shapes are driven by a powerful stepper motor that does the rotating and a really interesting linkage that does the tilting. Now, you need to be sure and watch the video for this one, because it's kind of a work of art. It's almost completely silent, except where it needs to not be silent, and it's pretty cool. It's a cool video. It starts with the basic proof of concept, using tape on the shaft of a stepper, and then it's a great video. So go watch it.
This is exactly what we were begging for last time we saw this. We were like, this is really cool. How does it work? The answer is this, whatever it is, 15-minute video where it's built from the ground up, but B, you get to see everything about how it works. That made me very, very, very happy. Right. It's like some kind of weird universal joint. And so it pivots forward and backward, and then it's able to turn at the same time. And so the turny part's driven by the stepper motor and driving the pivot. It's a second stepper and a cable mechanism. Oh, how cool. If you are a fan of insane mechanisms, this is the video for you. If you're a fan of crazy, switchy mouth, Selectric dudes in bowler hats, this is the project for you too. Well, speaking of deep rabbit holes, my next hack is Lucas Tusk's running code on a PAX credit card payment machine. And this is the documentation of his work over, he says, 4.5 years on a particular family of credit card processing machines. A lot of the hacking here is made extraordinarily difficult by the fact that these are high security machines. They're meant to not be hacked. And so, as he says, whenever he does work on machines like this, he buys 3 of them. One to try to open and just let all of the protections go so that you can figure out what they are. A second one where you can actually attempt to bypass the protections along the way. And then a third one to keep in its pristine form so you can compare a working machine against the ones you have possibly broken in your attempts to reverse engineer. So this is machine number 1. This is the one where he just opens up and lets it all fly. It's a really neat demo of the kinds of things that these machines that have to be secure because it's processing your credit card details. Like, you really don't want someone to be running malware on this and rerouting the transactions or whatever, right? Like, serious mayhem. So it's great that they're tamper resistant. He said there aren't switches, actually, when you undo the screws on the case. But the second you remove the back of the case, there are switches that permanently open and it locks the non-volatile memory. So you're not getting the keys out. The board has, it looks like a 2-layer board, but it's actually a 4-layer board. And it has a dense mesh in the middle that serves as a protective layer. So you can't drill through the board to get at the other side, even if you tried, because it's got this mesh there to detect if you're doing that. Why would you want to get at the other side? Because there are even more switches that sense when you pull the PCB out of the case, right? So what, it ends up being like a high security puzzle box or something. And the question is, can you get in and access the debug points on the board without tripping any of the tamper switches? And he hints that he has actually in this write-up, but won't tell us how. And that's fine by me. I love the screen where he's like displaying all of the tamper switches that he's triggered on the way in. It says switch external 0, external 1, external 2, all the way down to like external 7. After having triggered all these, he ends up with the chip, which is kind of a mystery. It's an MH1903 made by Mega Hunt. And if you've heard of them before, you are not me. They make high security microcontrollers, apparently. But it's basically an ARM core on the inside. Binaries are not encrypted, and he's able to dump one, but they're signed, so you can't change them and re-upload them to the thing. And the thing has non-volatile memory anyway, and it's a one-time flash chip, so basically doing any more hacking on this device once he's gotten it opened and all of the security things are tripped. Basically, there's nothing you can do at that point. And, you know, A, that's awesome from a security perspective, but B, it's a bummer if you wanted to play with this device. So he takes the last resort, which is to buy a bunch of these MH1903 chips, figure out how to program them, desolders the one that's on the board, and loads his own in there. And that, of course, because it has his code and not the if the switches have been tripped, don't ever run again code. He can then write whatever he wants and load it up there. And so he has a little I owned it in Brazilian Portuguese that he loads up, and hooray, hooray. So that's where this one ends. The chip's kind of powerful. It's got a lot of memory on it. It's got a nice screen. He suggests that he might port Doom to it. We'll have to see. I mean, of course you would, right? But
sure.
But I think there's no way you could do that. At least it looks like there's no way you could do that without essentially completely opening the thing up, replacing the CPU and its flash memory, and starting entirely from scratch. So from a security perspective, I think that's a good thing. I mean, I'm stoked to not have my credit card skimmed. Thank you very much. Really, really neat look over the shoulder of someone taking apart one of these high security devices, even if it is built by a Brazilian manufacturer named Tech Toy. I kid you not. Apparently they started off as a little toy manufacturer and then moved into high security banking equipment.
Yikes. That's quite a story.
I think they licensed them from one of a couple companies, so maybe it's not as bad as it sounds.
My next hack comes from Kobe Unger. Jointly is a typeface designed for CNC joinery. What? I'm going to gently pivot from typewriter mechanisms to typefaces. And this one is doing double duty as CNC joinery. That's right. These joints are legible. So the letters are the mortises, and they slot into matching letter-shaped tenons. Now this could probably only be done with the magic of CNC, and it's true that the font required some tweaking in order to get this to work at all. It had to be curvy, for one thing, and both the inner and outer contours had to be accessible by a rotary tool. As Tyler points out in the write-up, those tenons either took some serious Z-depth or some kind of interesting jig, and apparently it took both. Kobe mentions that a handheld CNC router might have been cheaper. But what and what exactly was the point of all this? Well, to create a really cool set of shelving units with an entire poem as the joinery, which you can see on the project page. So go check it out.
Yeah, you really have to look at that one to get it. It's like it's shelving, and the place where the shelves slot into the whatever the vertical bits that hold them up are is where you can read the text through. And if you pick like different woods or whatever, you can read it. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
The font he used in this is the Gorton font that we actually reported on 6 months ago, 7 months ago. It's the font from an old machine tool company of way, way, way back that's been in kind of quasi-public domain and used on a whole bunch of machines. That alone is interesting. This is crazy. Like, it's just such a great idea. Once you start doing CNC joinery, you can do anything. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't appreciate as much as I wish they did. We've written a few articles on it. It's really cool to be able to cut something by hand as simple as a dovetail. But when you have a CNC machine, you can make crazy shapes that interlock with each other. We wrote up a really neat piece that had an interactive software design to make those Japanese three-way tsugiki joints. And the way the software worked, you could like push one tooth over and another tooth would sprout out in the other dimensions and it would automatically cut everything for you and do some analysis on whether your parts were too thin or too thick. It was really, really, really crazy cool. Like half automated design of insane joints by machine. Really, really awesome. A couple of others, I'll throw some links in for you. My absolute favorite is the great granddaddy of all CNC joint pieces. It's called 50 Digital Wood Joints by Jochen Gross, and I'll send that into you. He was saying, okay, we're using CNC machines. Why are we cutting boring joints? Why don't we just freak out? And instead of making tenons round, why don't we make them oval or puzzle shaped or interlocking, you know, so that there's only one orientation you can put things together, or so that there's, you know, self-justifying and things like that. It's a really, really cool piece of work. I think from the late 90s, early 2000s. Definitely, definitely go check that out. Yeah, but using text is next level.
It's very cool. I want to know why Kobe was able to open up the P's and the B's, but not the A's.
Oh, I'm going to have a look.
Oh, you can see it in the inset picture in our article.
So what do you mean? Oh, I see. The A doesn't have its hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no A hole.
Said the flautist. maybe it's because the bit's too big and it's just hard to get in there.
Okay.
The bit itself has a certain radius, and so that's kind of the smallest feature size you can make. And so if you try to make like a pointy thing, like on the inside of the A, you know, where it makes that triangle, right? You can't put a sharp point on the triangle because you have a round drill bit trying to fit into that little sharp
corner. I
wasn't
expecting a triangle, but just a round hole like the P and the B.
Maybe it's just too small and it's fragile?
Okay, yeah.
I don't know. I'm spitballing, though. I don't know for sure. He said that's why he chose this font. It's because it was easy to make everything kind of round and roundly contoured and still work. Who is it? Medix comments a little bit unkindly that it gives him the Comic Sans in wood vibes, which I guess because it's rounded over, it does a little bit. But yeah, you're stuck with that. You can't make sharp edges. It has to be rounded off because you're cutting with a rounded tool. And so, you know, there's no way to get around the radius of the bit you're cutting with. Well, today is just a show of amazing feats. My next one, original Mac limitations can't stop you from running AI models, is a sweet bit of work by Ken Designs. And one thing I really love about retro computing is, you know, there's this one flow of retro computing that's just kind of, oh, nostalgia. It's cool to see that blue screen again and type 10, print hello, 20, go to 10. And then there's this whole other side of retro computing, which is like, if we knew then what we know now, both about the machines and other algorithms, what kind of crazy, mind-blowing stuff could we have done? This is where Ken's AI running on an old Macintosh fits in my mind. This is kind of hacking on a computer from 1984 to do, yeah, not the fanciest AI models. He's doing character recognition. In particular, he's doing the numbers out of the MNIST data set. But this was a revolution in the mid-90s that you could make artificial neural network models recognize digits so well that you could, for instance, use them in the post office and automatically route mail with it. This was like a real thing. And here he is trying to implement this on a computer from 10 years prior to that revolution in 2025, 40 years later. So that sets the stage. What's going on here is that he, I mean, these kind of old school neural network models on the running side are really not very hard. It's multiplying a bunch of floating point numbers together, adding them up, and repeating and repeating and repeating. And so each hidden layer is a sum of activation weights and blah, blah, blah. What it's actually doing when it's running and recognizing the letters isn't very, very hard, except it is expensive in terms of RAM, which he doesn't have on the old Macintosh. And if you did it in full floating point, which is what people usually do, you'd kind of want a floating point processor, which he didn't have on this old Macintosh. So what he does is he kind of shrinks the algorithm down. And so he ends up using, and oddly enough, that's what they're doing with today's like super hyper billion parameter models as well. They're shrinking them down into 4-bit or even 1-bit. Here he is taking the classic artificial neural network perceptron model, shrinking it down to use 8-bit integers instead. So it doesn't have to do floating point and it doesn't have to use up so much memory to store the weights. And it works very well with the Macintosh's processor at the time. So no problems there. A lot of the heavy lifting, the training of the model to recognize the handwritten numbers, is done on his real computer. So in Python with, you know, essentially unlimited RAM and processing power, at least relative to the size of the problem. So he crunches down to the weights on a big computer, runs them on the 6800 or 68 million, whichever those are, those old Macintoshes. Still, to get this thing to run in mostly real time, he does end up having to ditch the Macintosh operating system, which is slowing it down. And this is where his side project, a custom bare metal software development kit for the Macintosh, comes in. And so he's basically running this thing like it were a microcontroller project, except with all of the peripherals of a Macintosh. So he's kind of written his own proto operating system for the Macintosh that this is running on, and that's why it runs so fast. So that's a second layer of cool in this project that comes kind of out of nowhere about halfway through his video explanation. He's like, oh, and the reason the C code runs so fast is because I'm running it on bare metal and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, a little bit of a power move there. Anyway, this is the sort of thing that had someone done this in 1984, it would have just been mind-blowing how much speed and power you could get out of this old computer. And then, of course, we didn't have the algorithms until a decade later. So, you know, it would have been absolutely black magic had you been able to do this in real time in the mid-80s. So that's what I love about these kind of projects. It's not impossible to do this today, but it would have been impossible to do it then, but he's doing it with the same equipment then. The only thing that's changed is technological progress and human knowledge, and that makes all the difference, and I love that. Go team humans.
Yeah. Speaking of amazing feats, how about that UTF-8?
Right?
My last regular hack comes from Vishnu. UTF-8 is beautiful. Without it, how would we ever communicate as grandly as we can today with our diverse alphabets that make cool table-flipping faces and everyone's favorite emojis? I certainly don't know. But you may know that UTF-8 takes the veritable 7-bit ASCII character set and extends it to multiple bytes in order to paint thousands of characters while still being backward compatible with ASCII. That's crazy. But how? As Vishnu's excellent primer explains, the first 128 characters are encoded with a single byte, which ensures backward compatibility with ASCII and makes it so that a file with only ASCII characters is a valid UTF-8 file as well. Other characters require 2 or 3 or even 4 bytes, and the key lies in the first few bits of each byte. It specifies two things: the number of bytes the character has, and the fact that it is a data byte. ASCII codes always have 0 in their most significant bit when mapped onto an 8-bit byte. As long as this happens, the backward compatibility is ensured. And as a cool special bonus, Vishnu made this UTF-8 playground tool so you can visualize and play around with UTF-8 encoding just by flipping bits. It's pretty fun.
We would not have the poop emoji without the wide range of characters that UTF-8 gives.
Yeah.
I had that snarky comment in my head, but of course, like, as I was thinking it, you said, you know, all the languages in the world, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's actually really serious and really important. And here I am thinking of my son texting me poop emoji after poop emoji. No, the fact that he can write umlauts so easily, the fact that I can read Chinese on my phone.
It's pretty cool.
Go UTF-8. All right, quick hacks. Starting off, I got Gabriel Wolf's oil-based Sprengel pump really sucks. The Sprengel pump, and I have to say it in German, is a really cool old-school vacuum pump, and it works by circulating a fluid, and every time the fluid goes by a hole that leads to the thing you want to suck a vacuum out of, a little bit more of the volume of air or whatever gets pulled out as the drops go by and pull them down. And this is an old pump design from the 1800s. Most Sprengel pumps, you actually use mercury for them, but liquid mercury is kind of a no-no these days. And he demonstrates getting this working with a modern pump oil. And the rest of it is just kind of working on this conceptually simple, but kind of devilishly clever pump mechanism from a couple hundred years ago. Thing I learned from this is testing for leaks in pipes with hot glue, because it gets sucked in. And so if that solves your problem, that's where the leak was. And then you can peel it off, because it doesn't stick very well to metal, and just rebraze the joint.
Whoa, that's neat.
Nice trick. Tool scientist, reverse engineering the Milwaukee M18 diagnostics protocol. Their tool batteries have a simple UART protocol that lets you know what their battery status is like. And this communicates with the chargers. It's a proprietary protocol, unfortunately. Super fortunately, it has a dump all your data command. And we wrote this up back in 2023 when tool scientists started this project. The problem with the dump all data is it just gives you all the numerical registers and then a bunch of numbers that mean something. And the last 2 years have been him mapping out by trial and error and abusing a bunch of battery packs and charging them up today and seeing what this field reads, waiting a day and seeing what this field reads. And by reverse engineering it and through help from the community, just dumping batteries data, he's got most of the fields figured out. And to get a feel for the scale of this, if you dig into his Python code, he's got 160, maybe 170 different fields decoded with what they mean by now. You give it the serial query command and it tells you what its total discharge is, the days since its first charge, the day since its last charge, what its current charge state is, what the maximum current it's ever seen was, how many times it's been in the range from 70 amps to 65 amps, how many times it's discharged in the range from 110 to 115, et cetera, et cetera. It's some super fine-grained information about how the battery has been handled. Almost all of it has been decoded. There's still a little bit of work left to do, but this is looking pretty cool if you've got Milwaukee M18 lithium batteries. Carl Anderson, a 10-inch telescope because you only live once. There's a lot of jokes about YOLO here, but it's the YOLO County. It's actually a place in California, got the name of this telescope, and it's a strange telescope design with off-center mirrors, and so they have to be ground in a very particular weird way. What's neat is that Carl built a jig to do this for him, and so often home-built telescopes have a very tedious multiple-hour and very sweaty mirror-grinding process to make them. This one, he just lets a machine do it, and you can watch it work in a video he's got attached. It's rough and ready, but it gets these kind of eccentric mirrors ground for him. And last up, Ludwin USB-C PD decoded a DIY meter and power logger for Power Insights. The USB-C is a little bit of a red herring here. This is just a power meter. But if you're ever in a project where you need to measure current, this is a great usage of the classic INA-219 chip. So, you know, you could do worse for a reference design than to follow this project.
Well, my first quick hack comes from Flurples, making a laptop with a mechanical keyboard. I sure do love my ThinkPad, which naturally I bought because of the keyboard. But evidently the ThinkPad or even the Framework 13 isn't good enough for Flurples, who decided to build an entirely new laptop around a custom mechanical keyboard. Now that is dedication. As you might imagine, this project requires a custom machined case to contain the keyboard and rearranged guts of the Framework 13. The end result has three of the four modular input ports, although one of them was sacrificed for a USB-A hub and an HDMI port. The keyboard has Kaiwa Chuck Sunset switches, and the PCB rests on O-rings for a better typing experience. Now, if you look hard, you'll notice three low-profile rotary encoders which blend in really nicely and pull the laptop together. Next up comes from Bogdan the Geek, hosting a website on a disposable vape. This one's from the Ridiculous Files, the ridiculous part being that these things have microcontrollers now for no real good reason. As, quote, disposable vapes become more tricked out, the natural thing to do is harvest more than just the lithium-ion battery. So to prove a point, Bogdan turned a vape into a web server called, lovingly dubbed, the Vape Server. I love that Maya calls them adult pacifiers, by the way. And Bogdan soon discovered that several of these things have Puya MCUs, which have come up around here several times with the cheapest MCU title. Now, the vape in question has a Cortex M0 Plus core that runs at 24 MHz with 3 KB of SRAM and 24 KB of flash. But this seems difficult, no? Yes. The limited hardware required the use of the UIP-TCP-IP stack along with SLIP and semi-hosting in order to create the serial device part and a visible IP address. And finally, I want to cook. When is your Pyrex not the Pyrex you expect? Pyrex is awesome stuff, and the fancy kinds with flowers are still highly sought after, and they go for a lot. Well, as it turns out, not all the plain Jane versions of Pyrex Bakeware is the same anymore, and evidently it's been much longer than I personally thought since the company changed from making high-heat durable borosilicate glass to producing items made of soda glass, which is a little less heat durable. Now, how do you tell the difference? The American soda glass version is now branded Pyrex, that's lowercase if you couldn't tell, while the European offering, which is still borosilicate, is branded Pyrex in all caps. Someone in the comments mentions that you can tell visually by looking at the edges. Soda glass has a green tint, while borosilicate has a more bluish tint to it.
All right. I'm looking at the video. I see it. I can see the difference. I will see the difference now.
You can see it in the picture.
I can't believe it. I laughed every time you said flurples. But just so our listeners know what she has to deal with recording this show, I laughed every time. Well, now it's time for our Can't Miss Hacks. These are long-form pieces written by our fantastic Hackaday writing staff. This week, I wanted to cover Maya Posh's Naturally Radioactive Food and Safe Food Radiation Levels. This was triggered by the shrimp recall a couple weeks ago now, where a whole bunch of shrimp that had 100 times higher than normal levels of cesium-137 in them got caught at the border and banned from entry. And 100 times more than the normal amount sounds like a lot, but as Maya points out in this article, it's actually A, well under the safe limit for how much radiation you can have in shrimp, and B, significantly under, say, what you'd get from a banana. And so the question that she's looking at in this article is, how the heck do we even decide what amount of radiation coming out of our food is normal, natural, acceptable, and how the heck do we deal with this? Like, bananas are the poster child, right? Because they have potassium in it, and some small amount of potassium is always radioactive. Shrimp also eat things that are in the ocean, and over the last 50, 80 years, we've done a lot of atomic testing in the ocean. And it's no surprise that the shrimp eventually eat things that contain fallout from these nuclear experiments. That's basically how the shrimp get cesium in it, and probably what happened here is that the shrimp ate some before getting processed. Cesium has a really short half-life, and so most of the time it kind of decays away anyway, and I think that's why most of the shrimp we get is not radioactive. Who knows what went on here? Anyway, the article's neat because it points out a few things. For one, radiation isn't just radiation. Long story short, this is why there are a bunch of different levels of radiation for a whole bunch of different contaminants. And I thought that was really interesting. She closes the piece off by looking at how these threshold levels even got determined in the first place. One of the answers is that the thresholds for acceptable radioactivity are based on models that kind of extrapolate down to super low doses from the really big doses where we can tell what it does bad to you. These are called linear threshold models. The linear is just basically saying that 10 smaller exposures is the same as one 10 times big an exposure. And whether that's true in terms of biological harm or not is actually kind of the subject of scientific debate at the moment. It looks like our bodies are actually okay at processing very small levels of radiation. We kind of repair around it and it doesn't cause cancer. Whereas these bigger doses all at once are pretty bad. This hasn't worked its way into regulations yet, and whether it will or whether it should is kind of an interesting public policy debate. The folks in the comments all come down on the side of, it looks like the linear model's no good, we should just make our levels of acceptable radiation higher. I'm not sure I agree with that. The problem with low-level radiation is it's really hard to detect, and the fact that we can't detect harm at these low levels, it's either because there's not harm being done or just because it's really hard to see small amounts of harm being done. And so which of these it is, I don't know. The nice thing about the linear model is it kind of assumes the worst. And so it's kind of like, you know, innocent until proven guilty. You know, the other take on this, which is, you know, you have to show that there's harm at these low levels of radiation to recall the shrimp, is saying that they're guilty until proven innocent. And I'm not sure that's the way you want to make a national radiation safety policy. So I'm stoked that they have possibly overly conservative radiation standards for the food we eat, even if, as a bunch of people point out, it may not be scientifically grounded. It's the cautious thing to do. But statistically seen, it is also the right thing to do. And so I think that's the right way to do it. And I'm stoked to be not eating hot shrimp, even though I like spicy shrimp. But bananas, man. Bananas, if you put them near a Geiger counter, they go click, click, click.
I want a Geiger counter.
We had one when I was a kid. We had one of those old civil defense Geiger counters. It took like 900 D cells and like was apparently they're not very sensitive at all. My dad, being my dad, had a couple radioactive things kicking around that we could test on in the house. So that was good. Including an ashtray from Arizona. It had an emblem on it and it had a really nice yellow field. And of course, it turned out to be uranium.
Oh.
Thing was hotter than. Whew. Click, click.
For my can't miss, I chose Al Williams's Forgotten Internet, The Story of Email. Where would we be today without communication tools? From the drawings in the cave of Altamira to the emojis of 2025, humans have longed to write messages and have them be read by someone. Al begins with the letter and the telegram, and in both cases, you have to know where to send the message, just as you do today. And in the early days, you had to visit the telegram office or the post office, or at least the mailbox, to get your message across. But commercial users wanted something better, which led to dedicated teletype lines. And by 1933, there was a network of teletype machines called Telex. Then came the fax machine, and the hardware was cheap enough to compete with Telex when it came to the average person. Well, then here come the computers. In 1962, MIT had a compatible time-sharing system, which had a way for users to share files, and so they did. And that same year, the IBM 1440 was released, which could send messages from terminal to terminal. It wasn't quite email, but it was certainly a good start. File sharing on MIT's CTSS led to a mail command in 1965. Every user had a local file, lovingly called mailbox, and anyone could cat messages to the file, but only the owner was able to read or edit the thing. By 1971, things sort of started to look familiar to what we have today. ARPANET got send message to handle mail between network computers and transfer files. Each had an address with a local part and a remote host name. Between them, the at symbol. The first message was transferred between two PDP-10s that were inside of each other. The inventor, Ray Tomlinson, is usually credited with inventing email. His program led to the development of similar programs within Unix and IBM soon after. Then came CompuServe. They started offering mail in 1978, aimed at commercial customers. Things developed from there, but normal people still didn't have access to the full internet. Then came AOL and the service I used, Juno, which is still around today. Al discusses a few email milestones, such as the fact that the first head of state to send an email was Queen Elizabeth II back in 1976. Jimmy Carter was the first known presidential candidate to use email that same year, and astronauts on the space shuttle were the first to send email from space. Apparently, it was pretty complicated. In modern times, the mail relies on SMTP, IMAP, and POP protocols that date back to the early 1980s. The technology that moves email around the internet today is largely unchanged, but the protocols have changed over time to adapt to TCP/IP and DNS. Plus, there are provisions in place for validating senders to prevent spam and encrypting messages. Did you ever use an email-only situation before having full internet at home?
We had CompuServe on dial-up, I think. I was a super young kid at the time, and I didn't have anyone to write email to. So it was, you know, it was my parents' account, right? But yeah, I mean, I know we had a 300 baud modem that could dial up to these things, but I didn't have anyone to send email to as a kid. The first email I can remember was when I was in college, actually, from my dad. That was one of the weirdest emails, though. But like back in the day, you had to go to the computer center, print it out on the fanfold paper and all that BS. But yeah, I got an email from my dad way, way, way back when. That was weird. He's a molecular biologist. He was actually doing a trip to Antarctica at the time. And this was sent from the Drake Passage on an icebreaker called the Polar Duke by satellite to email in like 1990 it was. And I had to go down to the center vax and print this thing out and read it. It was awesome, man. That was crazy. But like I say this and it seems like ancient history to me, and then I'm reading this thing and am totally shocked that email goes back to the late 70s slash late 60s. You know, as Al kind of points out, of course, as soon as they start to connect up computers, people are going to be writing to each other because that's what people do. We communicate with each other. But like, I guess I'm kind of surprised that the form and the ideas of email that we know now, like, you know, subject line and at sign and all that mess, is as old as like 1970 whatever. I guess I had thought that email kind of showed up in the late 80s or the early 90s.
Do you remember the internet yellow pages, like the physical books with?
No.
So
there was a printed internet yellow pages.
Yeah, yeah.
Done by the Yellow Pages company, the phone book people.
I think so.
That's wild. That's a weird last gasp to fight off the inevitable.
1996 edition.
All right.
There's a kids version, kids and family, safe sites for kids and family. There's a regular, just, you know, Wild West edition.
So this is a print phone book for the internet.
Yep.
Man.
I just searched Internet Yellow Pages book and it has a whole bunch of stuff.
Like, I'm totally willing to take this as a metaphorical book. But if it's a real book, that's just crazy. This is a rabbit hole.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm.
There's Internet Yellow Pages on eBay.
Oh, hot diggity. How much do they want for it?
For the 90s ones, like 30 bucks.
Oh, by the way, dig the Joe Kim art on this one. It's ancient Egyptian art with handing an email to each other. I love it. That guy with the falcon head is my favorite of the Egyptian gods. The jackal head one isn't bad either. That wraps it up for this week's Hackaday podcast. Thanks very much for listening. If you see anything cool or do anything cool, let us know. tips@hackaday.com. And as always, to follow the links we discussed in the show, head on over to hackaday.com/podcast. And until next week,
Keep on hacking.
Oh, what was I going to talk about here?
I don't know. I don't know. Good luck.
Gamma rays are good for turning Bruce Banner into the Incredible Hulk.
You're making me want to roller skate. Ooh, that's no good.
Will they ever learn? That looked cool, though.
I liked it, yeah.
Tomorrow's yesterday.
Flurples.
What is the Flurples?
What in the Flurples?